Well, good afternoon again, everyone. Having, of course, alerted you to the fact that you were going to wait a minute or two, the miracle happened and the traffic cleared and the Vice-Chancellor suddenly arrived, which is fantastic. I'm really very pleased to be asked to chair this session this afternoon because of my own background, as many of you will know, as being Chief Exec of Oxfam for 12 years and therefore very involved with the Education for All campaign across the world. And it's particularly nice, therefore, for me to hear your very own new professor in international education, Pauline Rose, talk about the report on where education has got to. But I'm also very pleased to make sure that actually we get the chance to hear from the Vice-Chancellor, who is going to give his introduction to why this report and why this issue is so important to him. So over to you, Vice-Chancellor.
Barbara, thanks very much indeed. Well, firstly, Pauline, welcome. I haven't had a chance to formally say that anywhere else, but I'm really pleased that you decided to join us here in Cambridge. So welcome on behalf of the university as a whole. I'm wearing two hats here today. As not just as Vice-Chancellor, this report is having an impact. Where? I chair a committee, the Department for International Development, as chair of the Research Advisory Board, which decides basically on where it puts its research running. This report matters. It makes statements and observations, that some of which were available in the literature, but it pieces it together in a way which is absolutely essential for its performance. My take-home messages from it, in my own field of medicine, were very clear. If you educate girls, you reduce maternal mortality, you actually reduce childhood mortality, you increase vaccination uptake, you improve everything that happened to prevent it. I can actually tell you, when you do the back calculations of all of the reports that are in here, it is cheaper and more effective than building any number of hospitals in developing countries. And that's got a very important message from my perspective, which is that education is far more pervasive and far more important than so many other things that can actually provide. And sometimes I think we don't make enough noise about how important education is. Second point, it's the quality of education. I think you make that stridently and well in this report to actually say that it's the quality of teachers that matter. This faculty is all about, like the rest of the university, about delivering top quality. It's not for nothing you are the top department of education in the United Kingdom, and by that, you are the top department of education, I would say, in Europe. And that probably means much of the world as well. That's quite something to live up to. I'm sure that's why Polly was tempted to come join you here. And sometimes in the university we don't say that often enough about just how good education is here. You might be one of the newer faculties, you might be one of the newer colleges in the university, but everything that you do actually supports the direction the university is taking. So, there is a third element why this report is brilliant. Please don't take this, Mr. Pauline. It runs to 450 pages. Those of you who worked in Whitehall will know no minister will ever read 450 pages, which means that every letter that you summarise something from this report is what the minister will read. It's factually based, but they're never going to delve into all of it. But it is a record, and an amazing record, a compilation of all of the work that has gone on around the world. So many, many congratulations to you and the whole team for delivering this, because I think this will change an awful lot of attitudes. And more importantly, it says absolutely, in a paramount way, why the Faculty of Education here, if you read what's in this, can actually lead the world and continue to do so, and aspire to do something that I want Cambridge to be doing worldwide, which is just as Barbara would have said from her Oxfam days, and I hope she continues to say so now in the Cambridge days, is that this stuff really matters. This is where we can make the difference. So more power to your other point. Keep on doing this, making sure that not just this, but we now move into the delivery phase of how we actually improve that quality of teaching. It's something that I remain very committed to, the university's committed to, please keep on doing it. Welcome to the university. Thank you for being here, and thank you for doing something that I believe is so important for the future of education globally. Thank you so much.
Now, I know the Vice-Chancellor's going to stay as long as he can, but it's sort of May week, and there seem to be a few things on about the university, so I know he'll have to slip out sometime. But again, I think, Pauline, you've now been well introduced, and it will be lovely to hear what's actually in the report. So, Professor Pauline Rose, in your own department, off you go.
Thank you very much, and thank you so much for those kind words. I should say that is exactly the reason why I came to the Faculty of Education here, the high quality of the research, the great environment and so on, and I'm looking forward to working with colleagues in taking forward some of the messages that one finds in reports, these global monitoring reports, which I think are sort of really key to ensuring that we improve the quality of education around the world. I should also say that I think it's really... for myself, and I think for the Global Monitoring Report team back in Paris in UNESCO, they would also feel very warmly the fact that this report is being read not only by people in education. We believe these messages. We know that education matters, but also by vice-chancellors of universities, by the CEO of Oxfam, who is now at Cambridge. And I think this is also a great sort of way to make sure that education is central, not only within debates on education, but also more widely. And that is part of the purpose and the intention of the, and the hope of the report. So I would like to just firstly thank people for coming here. I know some people have come from outside the faculty, and it's also great to have the opportunity to meet together. First of all, let me just explain very briefly what Education for All is, for those who might not know. In 2000, there were goals that were set by governments around the world who wanted to put on record that they were going to be held accountable for six areas in education to make sure that by 2015 they will have achieved goals that improve the quality of education, make sure all children, regardless of their background, have access to education at the primary level in particular, also to improve skills development and ensure gender parity and gender equality. So there's a set of six goals that they set themselves in 2000. So this report intends to monitor the progress every year towards those six goals. So if you haven't heard of the Education for All goals, you might have heard of the Millennium Development Goals, which these are connected with. So there's a Millennium Development Goal on education and also one on gender, which includes education within it. So that there's a link between those two. Now we're very close to 2015, and I'll be showing you how close we've made it towards those goals and also give an overview of the theme for this year's report. Every year there's a theme within the report, and this year it is on the quality of teaching and learning, so very relevant to the faculty here. But in terms of the monitoring, of course, we're very close to 2015. So a lot of the debates, there's a heated debate going on at the moment, this week as we speak, about what should the goals be after 2015. So we know whether or not we've made it, and you'll hear in a minute, whether or not we've made it for 2015, what do we want to set ourselves for after 2015? So that is very much on the agenda, and I would sort of encourage you to sort of keep an eye open for those debates and to get involved in them, because they will be quite influential for what is how education is going to be positioned between now and 2030, when the next deadline is going to be. And one of the intentions is to make them more global, to be more universal, because a lot of them have been considered to be more relevant to developing countries than to richer countries. And now the discussion is about making sure that countries like the UK are also held to account. Now, I just wanted to just give a quick overview as to what the report is. As the Vice-Chancellor said, it is this big, heavy report, 400 odd pages. About a third of it is the monitoring, about a third on the theme this year on the quality of teaching and learning. About a third is statistical tables, and then there's references and so on. So it's a big report, a lot of evidence that gets reviewed in there. You'll see there's about 30 pages of references from the academic literature, and the intention is to try and make it user-friendly for those people in DFID, but as you say, they won't read that report. We therefore in the team have devised sort of various other instruments that we would hope people would use sort of from different perspectives. So one of them is a database called the World Inequality Database on Education, which is a sort of user-friendly website, interactive website, where you can do graphics, download data, look at the extent to which there are inequalities both in access and learning, and it includes data from household surveys from 90 countries. And NGOs in particular have found it quite useful. Researchers use it quite a lot as well. We also have produced infographics of different kinds in order to make sort of rather complicated data analysis more visual. And some of this is in the report itself. Some of them are presented in booklets and in other forms. In addition, there are policy papers, and these are the ones that we do hope that DFID colleagues would read, and other donors, as well as others, national governments and so on, who we hope the report would reach. So this is the most recent one on aid reductions threaten education goals. DFID actually comes out quite well, because the UK is one of the few countries that has been increasing aid to education, but unfortunately aid overall, as I'll be showing in a moment, has been going down. There's a blog. If you're not already signed up to the blog, I would encourage you to do so. Easy way to keep abreast of the debates. There's a blog on the website, one or two a week, just sort of quite succinctly giving up-to-date information, new analysis and so on. And, of course, Twitter. So if anyone's on Twitter and you want to tweet, it's hashtag TeachLearn. So there's a variety of different products that come out of this big report that aim to try and get it into the hands of the policymakers. There's a launch of the report every year, one global launch, and this year it was in Ethiopia. And so this is a picture of the report being handed over by the Deputy Director General of UNESCO to the Deputy Prime Minister of Ethiopia. And again, there's sort of quite a lot of engagement. Although one has these big events and so on, there is quite a lot of engagement at the level of ministers, and in this case, a Deputy Prime Minister in the reports. It also reaches teachers. So this here is a debate that was in a classroom with teachers, in this case from Kenya and Pakistan. And this teacher here is, in fact, the teacher of Malala, who many of you will have heard of. She's absolutely brilliant. Again, you'll find a blog on the website. She's really passionate. One can see where Malala gets her passion from and the importance of the role of teachers in that as well. So there was a sort of interesting debate between the teachers and students as well on the messages from the report. So there are different ways of trying to get the report messages out there and making sure that they are taken into account at sort of different levels of policy. Now, one of the sort of real sort of bases of the report is that education is a human right. Everybody has the right to education, wherever you live, whatever your background. But of course, this doesn't always happen. So it's also important to make the case for education and why it is so important. So in the part of the report, there is sort of new analysis that was undertaken by a number of researchers who were commissioned for the report to look at the different relationships between education and different development outcomes. So these are just some of the ones that relate to why girls' education is particularly important. This was all based on rigorous analysis, but sort of boiling it down to numbers that can be easily digested, hopefully. So, for example, let me just take one example on nutrition. This is saying that if all mothers had secondary education, then 12.2 million children would be saved from stunting, which is equivalent to that they would not be malnourished, that there are sort of various pathways through which mothers' education will help to make sure that children do not suffer from malnutrition. All of these different areas are showing really strong impacts of the importance of education. In the report overall, there are five key messages. First of all, so I'll now tell you the headline message, is that by 2015, many countries will not have achieved the goals. Now, that might not come as a surprise. We know that there's still many countries that are a long way off getting all children into school, let alone having the relevant quality of education. So this is why we need to continue pressure on what needs to be done after 2015. Now, one of the messages of the report is a key reason why we have not achieved the goals is because these goals have not paid sufficient attention to the most marginalised. that the goals themselves might have had that in the wording. They weren't monitored, there wasn't sufficient data to actually monitor them to address issues of marginalisation. Strategies weren't in place to target the most marginalised. And so one of the big messages is that global education goals after 2015 must track progress according to the sort of social groups, economic groups, whether a child has a disability or not, whether a child is from a poor family, whether a child is a girl or boy. And the message, therefore, is that all children, regardless of their background, should meet any goal after 2015, given that these are the children who are most left behind. Another message is that one of the reasons why we haven't achieved the goals is because there hasn't been sufficient finance. Now, money isn't everything, and it's partly about how that money is spent as well. But if there is insufficient money in the system, as there is in many countries, this is not going to enable you to have a good quality education. And what we have seen in recent years is not only that there hasn't been sufficient funding, but from aid donors, funding to the poorest countries has actually declined. So this is why the report has argued that after 2015, there should be specific targets for the financing of education that governments are also held to account for, that are based on how those other goals need to be achieved. In terms of the thematic part of the report, it identifies that there's a global learning crisis that's hitting the disadvantaged students the most, and that this needs to be addressed by making sure that we have good quality teachers. Now, the report really emphasises the importance of policy makers supporting teachers. Too often we see, and this is often in developing countries, but also more generally, that it's teachers who are criticised for the poor quality of education. But actually, the reforms are in the hands of the policy makers. If they don't have the right reforms in place, then teachers cannot do their job. So as I come on to show, there are sort of ways in which policy makers need to put these reforms in place. I'm just going to give a quick snapshot of one of the figures that is most used in terms of identifying progress towards the Education for All goals. This, in a sense, can't tell us everything. It can't tell us about the quality of education, but it does tell us that if we're not making progress on reducing numbers out of school, then we're probably not making progress on other indicators such as the quality of education. So what we find is that the numbers of children out of school has declined since the goals were set. So since 1999, there were 107 million children out of school. Now there's 57 million. But what one can see here is that this has flattened. So most of the progress was actually in the earlier period. Now, that might have been partly the honeymoon period of having the goals set. It was probably also that there was low-hanging fruit. Children who were could get into school more easily were targeted, but actually the most marginalised are the ones that are still out of school and are sort of resistant to changing this figure here. What's of perhaps even greater concern is that this is on primary school. When we look at adolescents at the lower secondary school level, that curve is even flatter. So it's reduced from 101 million to 69 million. Now, a lot of the discussion for goals after 2015 is that we need to also include a goal on lower secondary education, which was not in the existing goals. Now, this is important both because primary education isn't enough to be in terms of a right, but also those figures I was showing earlier in terms of why girls' education matters. You need a lower secondary education to actually see those benefits. It's not enough to just have a primary education. When we look around the world, there are different parts of the world where progress has been slower. And so in terms of the out-of-school adolescents, those of lower secondary school age, we can see there's been no difference in the numbers out of school over this period, staying at 22 million. Now, the reason of that is partly population growth. So there are more children and young people enrolled, but the population growth has increased at the same rate. South and West Asia, similarly, has not declined as much as one would hope. If we look across the goals, this analysis, which is pencil shavings, but again has some quite detailed analysis behind it, is showing the percentage of countries that are expected to achieve the goals by 2015, so projecting forward. So looking at goal one, which is for pre-primary education, just under half are expected to reach that goal. Goal two on primary education, which is the goal that has received the most attention because it was also the Millennium Development Goal. But still, only 56% of countries are expected to have all children enrolled by 2015. Goal three, which sort of was on skills development, but it's one of the difficult goals for having good indicators. This is one of the challenges of the monitoring. So looking at lower secondary education, 46% of countries. There are quite a few countries that don't have data for lower secondary education. Adult literacy is actually the goal that's furthest behind. So we've been paying more attention to the extent that, you know, we can see that these numbers are bad, but they're not as bad as the adult literacy. So for adult literacy, only 29% of countries are expected to have the majority of adults literate. Now, this is partly because the world has really neglected adult literacy. If you look in education plans around the world, there's often not a strategy for it. There's not funding for it. If there are programs, it's usually run by small NGOs without government backing. So there's a number of reasons why this has really been left behind. And it was interesting in the post-2015 debates that actually it wasn't initially being included. There had to be some encouragement to get it included. So I know there's some experts on adult literacy in the room here. So I think you've still got a job to do to make sure it stays on the agenda and actually moves up the agenda. In terms of goal five, which is on gender parity, it's actually a goal where we have made greater progress. This is equal number of girls and boys in school, so it's not gender equality. It's not what we need to achieve in terms of empowering women, making sure there's no discrimination and so on, which would be what you would need to achieve gender equality. But in terms of equal numbers, we can see that 70% of countries are expected to achieve gender parity by 2015, a lower proportion, 56% for lower secondary. Now, goal six is on the quality of education. It's more difficult to summarise in a way like this, but I'll be coming on to talking more generally about that shortly. Now, it's not just about these averages, but it's about also knowing who it is that is out of school or not learning. What we did in the report is to look at, in low-income countries, in sub-Saharan Africa and so on, how many years, on average, have different groups spent in school? Now, I mean, I find this quite striking, and I wasn't expecting it. I was expecting there to be inequality, but I wasn't expecting it of this extent. So what you can see for low-income countries, that the richest urban boys have spent, on average, 10 years in school, so that's equivalent in many systems to lower secondary education. The poorest rural girls have only spent 3 years in school. So a lot of the discussion at the moment is that We've done access, you know, we've improved enrolment, we need to now move on to learning. In fact, we need to do both. We can't do learning without solving the access problem. Otherwise, there's going to be many girls, poor rural girls, who don't have that possibility. Of course, poor rural boys are also in a difficult situation. It's the sort of richest, it's those living in urban areas, and those boys in particular in those areas that are doing the best. And similar pattern across these different groups. Now, the report also then projected forward to see, okay, based on recent trends, how long will it be for these different groups to actually achieve primary school completion and lower secondary school completion? Again, the results shocked me. For primary, the richest boys aren't quite there, but by 2021, you'd expect them to achieve it. This is in low-income countries. For poorest girls, it won't be until 2086. So we're setting these goals for 2030, and we think actually we've done quite well on primary, but if we don't do something that targets the poorest, those living in rural areas, etc., then we're not going to still have made the goals by 2030 unless we do something differently, and we'll be even further behind for lower secondary. Now, in addition to monitoring the trends across the goals, the report also looks at the financing of education. We can't achieve goals if we don't have sufficient resources. Now, of course, for almost all countries, the main source of funding are domestic governments. So the report looks at, this year was looking at the extent to which there are sufficient resources that come from the government budget in the first place that are available for public services. Are they making this line here? So are they above this line? And also, are countries giving sufficient priority to education? So this 20%, are they giving 20% of the total government budget to education, which would mean they'd need to be on this side here. So we can see only these countries here fit into that group. We've got most countries here, which mean that they're not meeting either of those objectives. country like Pakistan, which is extremely low, both in terms of the tax revenue as a share of its GDP, which is around 10%, and less than 10% that's spent on education. And of course, we know Pakistan has a huge problem. It's the second country with the second largest number of children out of school, so it can't afford to not be spending more on education. Now, at the same time as this, for the poorest countries, many of the poorest countries do still need external resources to support their education systems. They've got massive challenges. They can't do it on their own. Aid has actually supported the improvement in education in many countries. So in Tanzania, for example, you can see improvements both in getting more children into school as well as the quality of education, thanks to both the support of the government resources, but with also donor support as well. But what we see here is in the last 2 years for which data are available, there's been a decline, and the projections forward look like that's going to continue to happen. Now, that has happened across all these different levels of education. Well, it's actually particularly happened at the basic level of basic education, so at the level where we see poorest rural girls are still not getting access. And of this 5.1 million that's available for basic education, only 1.9 actually goes to low-income countries. So there's a real issue about targeting of the resources as well. Moving then to the thematic part of the report on teaching and learning. The report identifies that there are 250 million children around the world who are not learning the basics. Now, that means that around 1 in 3 are not learning to read with understanding. They're not able to count and so on. Now, this is, really a tragedy, and something that I think is these figures are a bit of a wake-up call to say we need to do something that addresses the quality of education. Now, of course, this is a problem around the world. It's more located in certain parts of the world. Again, sub-Saharan Africa fares particularly badly. But to give a bit of good news, because I know that a lot of this is quite dismal, but to give a bit of good news, because there have been an increase in the number of children going to school, there's been an increase in enrolment. What we see in sub-Saharan Africa, that in absolute terms, there are actually 17 million more children learning the basics than there were in 2000. So there has been an improvement. That's because of the increased numbers actually going into the system, not because the quality of education has been improving. So there's still a large number who are either not in school at all or who aren't making it to the last grade or who aren't learning even though they're in school. So these ones here, they are in school, but they're not actually learning these basics. So they've spent at least 4 years in school without learning the basics. Now, this poor quality of education leaves a legacy of illiteracy. The report finds that there are 175 million young people in low and low middle income countries who cannot read a sentence. So this is the sort of very basic. They're unable to read. Of these, 40% are in sub-Saharan Africa, and 61% of them are women. Now, these young people are often neglected in the education policies. These are going to be the adult illiterates of the future unless we do something about it. Going back to what's happening within the school systems, it's inevitably the poorest children who are learning the least. So looking across African countries as well as Latin American countries, we see this wide gap between the poor and the rich. So this is a sort of universal problem. Of course, in some countries, when we're getting towards the top here, inevitably it narrows, but many countries that gap is extremely wide. It's, of course, not just a problem in the poorest countries, it's also a problem in OECD countries. And what we find here is that when you look across the grades, when you move up the system, that there's a widening of the gap. So looking at England, for example, you can see how the gap between the poorest and the richest increases between grade 4 and grade 8. Now, on the other hand here, Australia doesn't widen, but I'm afraid they're doing pretty badly in terms of the overall gap. So the report then looks at what we need to do to change this. So its overall message is that policymakers must support teachers to end the learning crisis. When we were doing the report, we wanted to come up with some sort of graphic to try and sort of summarise what those 200-odd pages, that part of the report, was saying. And we thought, actually, what this is about, in a sense, is that it's not easy for policymakers. They have all these balls that they're juggling, and if they drop one of them, then everything actually can go to pot. So we sort of devise this sort of juggling system for the policymakers, saying, OK, there are these 250 million children who aren't learning. The policymakers need to, first of all, recruit the best teachers. They need to train them and train them to make sure that they are have the skills to teach the most disadvantaged students. They need to allocate them to the parts of the countries where they're needed the most. And they need to have strategies to retain teachers. Now, work by the UNESCO Institute of Statistics, with whom the GMR works closely, does analysis of how many more teachers we need. So it's not just sort of getting the best teachers, but getting enough teachers in the first place. And it estimates that we need each year an additional 3.7 million teachers around the world just to replace teachers who are leaving the system, whether because they're retiring, going to other jobs, they're sick and so on. But in addition, there are 1.6 million more teachers that are needed to achieve universal primary education. So this is only for primary education, not for other levels. And 60% of these who are needed are in sub-Saharan Africa. Now, on the basis of the sort of review of evidence from around the world, the report comes up with a number of recommendations in terms of, in this case, the recruitment of teachers. So it shows that what we need to do is make sure that all trainees have at minimum completed secondary education with good grades. Now that might seem, do we really need to say that? That's sort of pretty obvious, but actually in many countries that's not necessarily the case. That they might not have completed secondary education, they might not actually have got the grades sort of that would show that they have actually the basic knowledge to teach their students. There also needs to be a good balance of male and female teachers. As we know, around the world, this can vary as to where the imbalance is. But in countries where the gender parity or lack of gender disparity is at the expense of girls, where there are very few girls in school, there's also very few female teachers. Now, this might just be a correlation, but one knows also that in those circumstances, there's often issues around the need for girls to have appropriate guidance, that parents don't always feel comfortable in sending their girls to school where there is no female teacher at all, which can happen in some of the rural areas and so on. So there is an issue about addressing that balance. And also making sure more generally that there are teachers from diverse backgrounds, that they different cultural backgrounds, different language groups, etc., so that the teaching profession also reflects the diversity of the children in the classroom. So the second strategy is about training teachers. Now, of course, in this country, we would be complaining about large class sizes. This is the pupil-teacher ratio, line of 40 to 1, which is suggested on average is sort of acceptable for across the world. But actually, we can see, some countries, these particularly West African ones, are above that. But when we look at the number of pupils per trained teacher, we can see it just goes skyrocket. So this is Central African Republic at the end, for example. There's an average of almost 160 pupils per trained teacher. So in some of these countries, as enrollment has increased, governments have recruited untrained teachers to cope with this increase in enrollment. And of course, that's an important short-term strategy. But in the longer term, something needs to be done to make sure that all students are taught by good quality by teachers who have the skills to teach in the classroom. So then policymakers need to make sure that they provide not only pre-service but also ongoing teacher education. That teachers need to be equipped with the skills to meet the needs of those from disadvantaged backgrounds. Now, I'm not very familiar, actually, with the training systems in the UK, so you can correct me if I'm wrong, but when we were doing the review of the evidence from here, we found, actually, this was quite a universal problem. It wasn't just a problem in the poorest countries at all. Many OECD countries do not include sufficiently within their training programmes elements that make sure, not just elements, but actually streamline it and mainstream it, the need for teachers to be training those who come from disadvantaged backgrounds. Now, maybe it's just because it's not actually being analysed in the evidence of the type that we would need for the report, and it is there, so that could be a research project to look into. At the same time, that teacher trainees need to have classroom experience. In many countries, and for example, in many sub-Saharan African countries, there's very sort of, their courses are very academic. They're expecting the trainees already to have a basic knowledge. Very academic courses, and they don't get any classroom experience. And so then they go out into a rural area and are expected to be able to cope. Once they're in that rural area, they then are left to their own devices. So the second part of that recommendation is that they need mentors once they're there too. Of course, as we know, training must not stop once teachers are in the classroom. They need ongoing training, and they need particularly to sort of have the possibility to update their skills and knowledge and support. And, you know, from the point of view of the messages and the support in how to support the children from disadvantaged backgrounds. And the other point is that also teacher educators need training too. This is, again, something that we found very little evidence from anywhere around the world. So the third aspect of the recommendations relates to the allocation of teachers to reach the most disadvantaged. In countries where there's a shortage of teachers, we find that there's often there are sufficient teachers in urban areas. There might even be too many teachers in urban areas, but there are insufficient teachers in rural parts of the country. So the class size in rural parts of the country would be far higher than in urban areas. That there are insufficient teachers who can teach in languages that the children will understand in the classroom. As I've already said, there's a gender imbalance, and again, this gender imbalance is reinforced by the urban bias, with many female teachers often in urban areas and very few in rural areas, and also particularly at secondary level, a shortage of particular subjects. So the report sort of reviews the evidence on the types of incentives that have been given to teachers to make sure that they have the incentives to work in different parts of the country. Of course, where there's no transport, where there's no health service, etc., it's hardly surprising that a teacher isn't going to want to go to a certain part of a country or stay there. So it needs to be part of an integrated package in the first place. There needs to be housing for teachers that's secure. There needs to be transport and so on. But also teachers potentially need a supplement to their salary because the costs for them to get to health clinics, to do other things, etc., that they actually need to have something that provides them with an incentive to stay there. So there are some examples where that has happened and has worked, but that incentive has to be high enough. Another strategy is to actually recruit teachers locally from the local area. This will obviously have an impact on whether there are sufficient teachers and people in that area who have the level of qualifications needed or need the sort of to be upgraded to make sure that they can teach. So the fourth strategy is about providing incentives to retain teachers. Now, we know that everywhere around the world, teachers will always be sort of complaining about the need for higher wages, and of course this is always an important issue. But I think it's particularly important in some of these countries here, at the top of this graph here, so where in at least 8 countries, teachers are actually paid less than $10 a day. So if you think of a family, that this teacher has to look after their family, has to support their family, this is not enough for them to do that. Now, even countries that are above that line, it's still not that they have a good salary. So where teachers are being paid so poorly, it's probably inevitable that they're taking on other jobs, which they often get criticised for and a reason for why they're absent. So the report also has recommendations about providing incentives to retain the best teachers. So first of all, where they need to be paid at least enough to meet their basic needs, and also to have for the salaries to be good enough relative to other professions with similar levels of expertise, experience and qualifications. And in some Latin American countries, for example, you can see that that's not the case. So the status of teachers is low partly because of that, and it's not attracting the best into the teaching profession. Secondly, also, is about how one motivates and incentivizes teachers to make sure they stay in the profession. Of course, around the world, there's a lot of debate about performance-related pay. Even in the US, where this has sort of been tried in various ways, they don't have very good ways of sort of actually measuring the value added of teachers. And so it's in poorer countries like Kenya, where they've trialed it, it's not very clear that this is actually going to be very effective. But there are approaches where giving teachers an attractive career path, steps up the ladder, and rewarding those in particular whose students are at risk of not learning. So not just saying, okay, on average you're doing well, but actually making sure that they're focusing on the most disadvantaged and helping to narrow those gaps that I was showing. Now we know that there are, again in many parts of the world, issues with teacher governance. So on the one hand, policymakers need to support teachers, but somehow policymakers also need the support of teachers to make sure that they're in the classroom, that they're doing their job. Now, there are reasons sometimes, as I was saying, why this isn't happening. But first of all, there are circumstances of gender-based violence, and this needs to have strategies in place. This is not acceptable anywhere. And in some countries, there have been measures put in place to put together codes of misconduct together with teacher unions and the local education authorities and communities. And it's those types of strategies where they've brought together those different groups that have been most effective. So it's not enough just to impose a code, because that's probably not going to be implemented. But when these different stakeholders have got together, it has made a difference. Secondly is around reducing teacher absenteeism. The report argues that you need to look at the root causes of teacher absenteeism. Are teachers absent because they're having to travel a day to go and get their pay, and then they get to the place where they're supposed to pick up their pay and the money's not there, so they have to do it again another day? Are they having to travel somewhere with a family member to go to the health clinic, for example? So you need to understand what the reasons are and tackle those reasons, rather than just criticise teachers for being absent, which is often the case in a lot of the policy, sort of international policy environment, at least. And thirdly, that there needs to be measures to ensure that teachers aren't offering private tuition to their own students. So one of the approaches that teachers use to top up their salaries, particularly where they're low, is to offer private tuition. Now, in countries like Egypt, unfortunately, what's found to happen is that teachers are then not teaching the curriculum in the classroom itself. They're holding back the curriculum and expecting students to pay. And not only is that obviously sort of a problem for the quality of the education, but it's also meaning that only some students, not all students, can pay. And that's the reason why the poorest are dropping out, because there's no point in them staying when there's nothing going on in the classroom. Now, it's not enough just to make sure that we've got all the teacher policies right. We also need to have an enabling curriculum and assessment strategies. So the report identifies that in some countries, the pace of the curriculum is so fast that those at risk of not learning are not going to keep up. And particularly when you've got large class sizes, a teacher can't actually give the individual support to all these students. So in India, for example, the pace of curriculum does not actually allow for that type of support. Whereas in countries like Vietnam, there have been measures to try and make sure it is more appropriate. That there also need to be approaches to make sure that classroom assessment is used with teachers to make sure they can identify and support low achievers, that they know who is at risk of not learning and work out ways to support them. That the evidence is very clear on the language of instruction in countries where there are multiple languages of instruction. In the early years in particular, it's vital that children are taught in their own language, because this has a much bigger impact on their learning. It both obviously makes them sort of feel more culturally integrated, but also has an effect on their learning. But interestingly, countries that had moved towards their own language are now, some of them, moving away from it. So Malawi, for example, is now implementing English as its language instruction, having put in place local languages before. Measures are needed to promote inclusion through the curriculum. In some countries, there are still strong gender stereotypes in textbooks, despite the fact that this has been on the agenda. People are aware of it, and policymakers should be aware of it by now, but they still persist, and just things like that need to be addressed. And finally, I mean, as I was showing, there are many children who are out of school, so it's not just enough to tackle what's going on in the classroom. You also need to provide programmes for those who aren't able to go to formal schooling, that give them opportunities to either re-enter the education system, formal education system, or to get the skills and qualifications to get work. So this is just my final message, and one I think probably most people here would agree with, that teachers need to be seen as part of the solution. Too often, teachers are blamed for the problems in education systems, but policymakers need to work with teachers to make sure that they're part of the solution. Teachers are the ones who know what the problems are in the classroom. They often know what the solutions are. And if policymakers don't work with them to make sure that the strategies that are devised are the correct ones, then what will happen is that something is imposed on them and it's either not implementable or that they're not sort of actually on board to undertake those reforms. And there's too many cases of that happening, and very few cases of where policymakers do actually engage teachers to the extent that they should. So thank you very much. Yeah.